Congas, bongos, and timbales, oh my! On January 27th, Puerto Rican percussionist Freddie Miranda Jr. leads his salsa and Latin jazz band in HPR's Atherton Studio. Purchase tickets to the Freddie Miranda Jr. Quintet January 27th at hprtickets.org. Preferred pricing for station members. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Achieve 3000. Its 2018 Hawaii Literacy Innovation Conference features Ray McNulty January 29th through February 1st. Achieve3000.com/community/events.
Today's program is a roundtable discussion of education in Hawaii.
It's a subject that affects everyone, and we're asking listeners to weigh in. What's your perspective? You can call us at 808-941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 on Neighbor Islands.
Our in-studio guests are Jim Sean, Executive Director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center, and Evan Beachy, Senior Education Consultant and Director of Kealaula Innovations Institute at Kamehameha Schools.
And joining us by phone, Sione Thompson, Executive Director of the Hawaii State Public Charter School Commission, and Superintendent Christina Kushimoto will join us in the second half of the show. What do you think of the curriculum being taught to your children? What would you like to see changed?
Again, those numbers are 808-941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 on Neighbor Islands. And thanks to our panel for joining us, and you know, we figured that today, given that there's going to be a great deal of discussion of education today, would be a pretty good day to introduce that subject ourselves.
Yeah, I think it's a really fundamental question that a lot of people are asking in the wake of all of this information that's now coming to light about learning and how we should go about teaching and how that teaching is no longer instruction. It's about coaching. It's about being student-centered. It's very different. And with that comes trepidation, because you have people who went to school, who went through a system where they may have done really well, and they believe that that's what their children should have. So they have a difficult time with the way things are kind of bearing out. So those questions need to be answered.
Jim Sean, Director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center, Evan, you just referred to information that flows in to the educational community. Does that, as new data are gathered, does that data get implemented?
Well, you pose a very important question, because the issue is not so much what does research say and what's cutting edge. How do you change a system? The culture of a system? How do you change habits? How do you change the forms you have to fill out to get the bus, to do the, you know, everything? Every system and every school really has its own world. And someone may go to a convention and get all hyped up. Oh, look what I learned. And they come back and they're the only ones who went to that convention. And everybody says, thank you for sharing. And now we go on to business as usual. So the theory of how a system can change and accept new data and new ideas is very much a part of this idea of choice. You know, most educators and teachers, they are trained to be employees. Here's your district, here's your school, here's your principal, here's your kids, here's your curriculum, here's your bell schedule, here are your forms, good luck, right? Whereas we do have forms in the private sector and in the charters where educators come together and actually create a totally new school, develop the DNA of that school, the theme of that school, what grades are going to be, what the curriculum looks like, what percentage of students are going to be engaged in any kind of a hands-on multidisciplinary learning. there's that level of choice that is potentially there. And then there's the choice of the teachers who come to that school who choose to want to work in a completely different environment. But the biggest choice is among the parents and the kids. You know, a charter school is the only school where the parents can block the actually opening of a school if they don't sign up, or can close it down if they walk away. That level of accountability and engagement is very rare in education, but we do have models of it. The question is, are we willing to tweak and change our structure of a large system to allow for that kind of choice?
Sione Thompson is on the line. Sione, can you hear us?
Aloha. Thank you for allowing me to join. Yes.
Yeah. We wanted you to weigh in on what Jim was just talking about.
Yeah, I completely agree with the panelists. I think as we look into the future and we try to see how and what we are educating for, and, you know, the great thing about charters and charter schools is that it's not a one-system model. And I think that choice really allows a lot of opportunity, one, for the student exposure and resources, because I think the more we can expose our students to more experience and not a systemized way of standardizing our curriculum. And two, there's a sense of belonging and a sense of ownership in one's education when a parent and a teacher in education make the choice to be at an institution that is responsible for, quote, educating our children for the future and what that looks like. So I do see a great amount of decentralization of resources. There's a lot more decisions being made, especially in the charter schools, but in education in general. Working with the superintendent, she had clearly articulated this decentralization of resources and having decisions being made at the local level. So I think that's a start. That's a start of the change agencies and it also is about people. It's also about getting the right people involved who, like what one of our panelists had just said, we're educated by a bunch of adults who have gone through a very monotonous system. And those are the people that have to now deliver education to our young. So can we change? Can the adults change? And it's about getting the right mindset, the right people involved. So, yeah, thank you.
Well, Jim, during your time at the legislature, I mean, it took a long time just to get the nod to go with the charter school idea. And, you know, it's taken off, and there's some very fine charter schools out there. But, boy, did it take a long time for us to actually change that system.
It did. You know, back in the previous century, Charlie Taguchi, as superintendent, came out with an entire plan for decentralization. And the system, the antibodies attacked this foreign idea very quickly, and it took to the late 90s before something that the kind of, they didn't call it the charter school bill, but it was Mike McCartney and David Ige, actually, who co-sponsored much more autonomy and grandfathered a few schools in. But it has been a long haul. And even today, for all the wonderful rhetoric of how we're student-centered and whatnot, it is the policy of the state to treat charters and charter students as second class, because we say to them, oh, we really don't have any obligation to provide you with a facility. We will spend $100,000 to cool one DOE classroom, but we will not spend $1 to give a charter school any classroom. The struggle is still there, but I would say if there's a silver lining for this, it has created an entire range of charter leaders who have had to be very innovative. They have found ways to survive and to thrive. And that's an important lesson, is that even in the face of great kind of institutional bias, if you want, they have created schools. Some of their schools do better on all the tests of all the public schools. You know, I mean, it's just true. We should, you know, the heroes of innovation and struggle and grit are these folks who started and kept going the charters in spite of those challenges.
Right, against all odds. And we should point out that Hawaii is the only state that has a statewide school district, and so you've got a bureaucracy, and so to move things along, it takes a considerable effort.
But again and again, the subject that, underlying subject is the pace of change.
The pace of change, that's right. Yeah. And change is very slow in all education institutions worldwide. You know, we should not think that we are somehow unique in this. It's a very conservative world, right, of change. And that's why power at the school level, in the charters, it's the governing board, that is its own board of education. But in the DOE schools, you do have these school community councils that have not yet been given an awful lot of power. But more power to them creates that sense of ownership that Sione was just talking about. If I own it, if I'm the decision maker, boy, my enthusiastic level goes way up.
Absolutely. You know, I completely agree with what, both of you are saying about this. You know, I think it is about ownership. And, to go back to a point you were originally making off of what I initially said, it is about system. It is about structure. It is about bureaucracy. But I think that sometimes it's important that we put our efforts into one kumu, one classroom, impact on those haumana, those students in the room, because that's where the rubber hits the road, right? So yes, we need to empower leaders. Yes, we need to provide leaders with leadership skills. But at the same time, I think we also need to remember that we can't miss the opportunity to work with our teachers to try to get things into classrooms right now. And in the charter school system, because of the fact that, again, you made, Jim, that you get teachers who come there because they believe in the mission and the vision. They believe in community. They're drawn there, and it makes that entire school community just that more tight.
You know, there's a real difference between thinking of a school as a high school and thinking of a school as an elementary school. In the elementary school, one teacher has that leadership flexibility to integrate the arts, to do everything, right? But once you get into middle and high school, I'm a chemistry teacher. Don't talk to me about social studies.
There's a caller on the line with three kids in charter school. Bob from Kapolei, can you hear me?
I can.
What was your comment, Bob?
Well, I wanted to say thank you to Halo Kumana, which is a charter school in Makiki. We got our kids through the foster system. We had relatives that were not doing well. We fostered the kids. We ended up adopting them, had them in the DOE system, and they were having a really hard time. They had identity issues. There was a lot of things going on in their lives as young kids that they didn't understand. One of my kids was on an IEP. They said he had developmental delay, et cetera, et cetera. So after some soul searching, we said, these are Hawaiian kids. We need to find a way to get them in touch with their heritage. And then, the additional things that happen at Halo Kumana is the amazing family involvement, the ohana involvement, the care and the sense of creating something new by the staff and the way that they took care of our kids. My daughter graduated last year, is doing fantastic. My middle, every one of my children has found direction at the school. Every one of my children has had an amazing wake-up moment where we were worried about some of them in their teens. They have all had an aha moment and figured out their direction in life. I'm very proud of each and every one of them for the decisions that they've made. And our involvement with that school has been amazing. Are they perfect? No. Do they make some bad decisions? Doesn't everyone? But as an experiment, as an educational experiment, I think that what they're doing is truly amazing. And we are absolutely grateful for the fact that they're able to exist. We'd love to see them get more funding. But if you cut their funding off, I think we'd go out and sell chicken or whatever we had to do to make the school survive. So thank you for allowing me to share that. I do think it's an amazing school. And I think that the opportunity that we have to be able to provide those very special places for our keiki is truly amazing here in Hawaii. We're very fortunate to have it.
Thank you, Bob. And Sione Thompson, you're still on the line as the executive director of the Public Charter School Commission. I'm assuming you were pretty happy to hear that.
Absolutely. Thank you, Bob, for your comments. It's just such a joy to see and hear of the success stories that are out there. We often talk about all the issues and all the problems that we need to change and how are we going to move this large system. But as you can see from Bob's testimony and his children that have flourished, that there are so many great things that are going on out there. And personally, I try to find ways, and the commission's trying to find ways on how to support, flourish, duplicate, replicate, all of those amazing things. So thank you.
I just wanted to toss in as well, you know, Halau Kumana is a wonderful place. And I think it's also emblematic of the Kanaiokana Native Hawaiian Charter School Network and their efforts. We have a huge number of those charter schools, and the indigenous lens that they, you know, come through, the cultural component, Hawaii, that is fairly unique in the charter school world. And there's a lot about identity that feeds into this idea of a community of learners. So that's also a really unique opportunity that we have here.
Absolutely. This is Sione Thompson. I just came back from a national conference, and you know, one of the big buzzes around was how do we take these culturally relevant and things that are locally relevant to our children? All of them come with an amazing gift and a talent, and they flourish at different times throughout their life. Hawaii is in such an amazing, unique position to best understand these cultural uniqueness with KS and OHA and all the other partners that so graciously give time and resources to charter schools. It's really been able to hone in on some of those things that we talk about, EQ and SQ. You know, how do you know that a student is passionate and they understand kuleana and they understand pono and they understand their responsibility of their heritage, of their culture? And it's all tied into curriculum. It's all tied into Common Core standards. It's all tied into literacy. And I think with those, Hawaii truly can be in the forefront of education moving forward.
If you're just joining us, you just heard from Sione Thompson, who is the executive director of the Hawaii State Public Charter School Commission. Our in-studio guests are Jim Shan, executive director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center, and Evan Beachy, senior education consultant, director of Kealoʻula Innovations Institute at Kamehameha Schools. We're urging listeners to call us at 808-941-3689 on Oahu or 1-877-941-3689 on Neighbor Island.
And I believe we do have a caller in on another line, line 3. Stefan from Wailuku, what's on your mind?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I'm calling kind of both as an academic and a parent. My area of research is cultural psychology, and so I'd like to applaud the charter school embracing of Hawaiian culture and generally bringing Hawaiian culture into the curriculum. I think that's an important thing because in the UH system, we see a whole lot of diversity. So I understand that in the classroom, it's not easy to cover, but I think we have to do it because we are such a diverse state. And then the only other thing I'd really like to say is critical thinking, anything that can encourage critical thinking. When the kids get to college, that's one thing that we noticed since the NCLB and the No Child Left Behind kids started hitting, is it seems that in that movement there was a loss of critical thinking emphasis. So anyway, good work on the charter schools, and I hope that can come into the regular schools.
Thanks very much, Stefan. And addressing that subject of critical thinking, I talked earlier this week with a retired venture capitalist, now turned educational philanthropist, Ted Tindersmith. He's been studying the emerging conversation about public, private, and charter schools around school redesign. He says that education in the U.S. has fallen badly behind, stuck in a 125-year-old framework that no longer meets the needs of students or employers.
I think it's an open question. Is our goal in any given discipline in our schools to teach a kid to think like a scientist or memorize the definitions and formulas of science, to think like an historian or memorize facts around history, on and on? I think when you teach somebody to think like a subject matter expert, that's an immutable competence that will serve them really well going forward that Google and online quick lookups will never replicate.
Ted Dindersmith has been visiting all 50 states holding conversations about America's educational system.
When you teach a kid to memorize a bunch of facts, honestly, they've forgotten it all. We have an example in the film and in my last book of a great school in New Jersey. Well, I think it's, I admire them, but it's a very expensive school, if nothing else, Lawrenceville Academy. You know, if your kid gets in there and you're on the East Coast, you do cartwheels. It's $65K a year for a high school kid for room and board and tuition. What they did was they tested kids. So they gave them their final in June. And when they came back in September, they retested them. And the faculty was a bit concerned. And they said there are things on the final that no kid would remember over the summer. So they said, okay, let's get rid of all the low-level things. Only test kids when they return on the core concepts we're confident every kid mastered. The average grade went from a B-plus to an F. And over 2 years and lots of classes and subjects, not one kid retained every concept that they thought every kid would retain.
That was educational philanthropist Ted Dindersmith. You can hear that entire conversation I had with him earlier this week on our podcast page. But the subject that he brought up is one that recurs again and again. What gets retained from what's taught in the classroom?
If I could just comment, as having been a history major at one time, and that is that critical thinking requires, like in music, you've got to know the chords and you've got to be able to read and you've got to know the melody before you can improvise. You can't think about patterns. You can't think about the bigger issues if you don't know anything. And I think many teachers recognize there is a tension here, right? And I know the trend is to say, don't worry about remembering anything. You can look it up at WikiLeaks. Well, you know, we found in civic education and in voter surveys the number of people who don't know anything about government. You know, they don't know anything about how it works or a constitution or layers or whatnot. It's not either or. You know, a rote education is memorize a bunch of stuff and don't think about it, right? The trend in the information age is don't know anything, just look it up and be able to apply some logic. I don't think it's either or. And I think many schools and teachers and others struggle with this idea is that, yes, you've got to know stuff, right? You've got, and what does it mean to learn something? It means you've learned it, you understand it, you can remember it, you can apply it, you can see patterns, you can apply it to areas that you didn't think it related to. And so this notion that it's just wide open, you got the internet, why worry about it, is one of the struggles, I think, particularly in history and social studies and others. If you first base is learn some stuff, second base, learn how to think about it, third base, apply it to the other world, then you get to home base, right? But if you don't get to first base, it's very difficult to get to second base.
I know you talk about technology, and I think, you know, it's important to bring that in because, let's say, in the private school sector, you know, you've got more ability and maybe more flexibility to seize on idea and run with it, where it might be a little more difficult in the public schools because of the system and the limitations with funding and all. I mean, I remember my child went to a school that had EdLine, and it's an open book, teacher's book all online, so you could know where your child was any given day, their assignments, their grades, and it was fabulous. And it, you know, it wasn't so much like it was they were, you know, somebody was on your back, but you got to see. So you couldn't come to the end of the semester and say, oh, Johnny's flunking. So it put the onus on both the parent and the teacher. I know there was some grumbling and resistance initially, but it was a very good tool. And I know I think the public school system did experiment with it, you know, and did a pilot in some schools. But again, to be able to roll it out to a statewide system, very difficult because of the funding issue.
Catherine, we want to involve a DOE Superintendent Christina Kishimoto in the conversation. Are you on the line?
Aloha, I'm here.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. So you're kind of coming in at the halfway point, and just to bring you up to date, we've had some discussions about the pace of change in education. Catherine just referred to the introduction of technology to education. What's your take on all this?
Well, I think that in the public school community, there's the opportunity because of the scale of the public school system to do and lead in the innovation space in ways that I think we often don't believe that public schools can. But the fact is that any model you find in the private sector or with charter schools, many of those models originated in public schools. Many of those teachers and leaders came through the public school system. And I think that we need to change our discourse from whether we're public, private, or charter to a conversation about how do we ensure that students are ready for their future regardless of which pathway they take. And become much more a partnership across education system types in terms of readying our leaders for the future.
Superintendent, we've got Evan Beachy of Kamehameha Schools and Jim Shan, who's the executive director of the Hawaii Educational Policy Center, with us in our studio. Jim, did you have a question to address to the superintendent?
Mm-hmm. Well, not so much a question, but a shout out to all those teachers and administrators who, in their own way, in all the public schools, are doing enormously innovative things, right? I think the new superintendent has sort of like given permission through dialogue and whatnot. Yes, go for it. Create. Take ownership of new ideas and whatnot. There's a tremendous amount going on out there. That's very, very difficult to get a handle on and document and celebrate. But I also think that there are aspects of the system that are getting in the way, kind of slowing us down. And over time, I think the superintendent and the board and others are going to peel those away. But the fact is that there are still a lot of bureaucratic forms that people have to fill out and get signed up and down the chain of command that get in the way a little bit, slow that down a little bit. And I give great credit to the superintendent and the board and all those teachers who are struggling to peel those barriers back and unleash the enthusiasm and the knowledge and the celebration of individual teachers.
And Jim, you shared with us a list of like 41 of the most innovative schools in the country, and many of our public schools are on that list.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
Eva Beach.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the superintendent is right. Is that the membrane between public, private, charter, DOE, and even homeschool, that membrane is becoming more and more porous, and is now more legitimate to share across it. And Kamehameha Schools is doing that tonight.
Well, it's not just Kamehameha Schools, and I think that that's the most important thing about this evening, is that it's a public charter, DOE, private school effort with Mid-Pacific Deeper Learning Network, Most Likely to Succeed Hawaii, which is Ted Dintersmith's organization, kind of coming together to put this evening in place. And I think that that's the kind of thing that we all need to do, to the superintendent's point. And the other point the superintendent raised was really related to teacher preparation. I mean, we have large numbers of kumu in all of our schools who are doing incredible things, and we have incredible leaders. But by the same token, what can we do to better prepare our kumu for the opportunity that they hopefully will get, which is to be empowered to do what they do professionally, apply their creativity, right? And those things.
I think
we're
at a point in just our education history and in terms of our collective mindset to really start talking about not what education system is leading particular work, because I think we're all doing some fantastic work and really starting to embrace innovation in education. But I do think we're at a point in our history to start asking, what do we need to stop doing? How do we really restructure how we design schools at a very localized level, with a very local context, and start to get comfortable with embracing the fact that one school does not need to look like the next school, but rather the outcome expectations and high expectations for all students is what needs to be held common, but the design of a school in terms of how we use time or what we consider curriculum resources or how we prepare teachers or who we call teachers and how we organize governance at a school, those are all variables that do not need to be fixed. And that's where we really need to push on the innovation front. Because we know we need to engage today's learners in a very, very different way. And one way in which I'm very passionate about is really engaging student voice and having students have an option about what kind of curriculum they engage in to solve the problem they want to solve, rather than having content completely controlled by the system itself.
Superintendent, I want to seize on a phrase you just used. What do we need to stop doing? That relates to something that, Jim, that you were talking about a little bit earlier.
Yeah, and I remember discussions of, if you're going to give a teacher more stuff to do, what do you take away? What do you take off their plate? That's true of the principal and all the staff and whatnot. And often enthusiastic initiatives flow out of the legislature or even the board. Hey, wouldn't it be great if we knew this or that? Let's do another survey. Let's do another report. People are going to have to take time away from, you know, the day in the life of that child to fill out the form, to work it all the way up. So I think, you know, that issue of time that the superintendent mentioned is so crucial. And when we talk about the student-centered school, we should be asking, what is a day in the life, a week in the life, a month in the life of a student? What does it mean when we say it's 2:30, get off campus, we have nothing more for you to do? The learning time and the engagement time of particularly adolescents, but for all students, is something that has been kind of almost hardwired even into collective bargaining. And my hope is that in the future, collective bargaining negotiations will address the issue of bell schedules and time to give much more flexibility to individual schools.
The way you get at that flexibility, though, it requires some really tough work, and it requires making lots of adults uncomfortable. We have in this state talked about the desire to move to an empowerment structure and an empowerment system. But the reality is that many people are not comfortable with empowerment. Empowerment means letting go of decision-making that is at the legislative board or superintendent or state level, allowing schools to make these decisions about these kind of infrastructure and curriculum matters, and then designing the state level and the legislature as supporters of those decisions. And so everyone talks empowerment. Very few people understand what it takes to put an empowerment system in place and how hard it is, and also what it means to let go. One of the things I often say is empowerment doesn't mean that you dismiss someone from the table that you no longer want to have input. But at the same time, it also means that school principals and teachers are the ones that are making decisions, and then all of us are supporters of those decisions. That's a very different way of working.
We have a caller on the line. Sean from Kaneohe has a point to make about unions.
Yes, perfect segue. It seems that the way teachers teach, or the quality of teaching overall, is predetermined by the union that represents them. In other words, if they're not good teachers, because they're union members, they're very hard to push aside. Vice versa, quality teachers must get the inverse effect of performing well. I don't want to seem bleak, so I'll just say what Neil Tyson said one time, that when you see kids cheering and leaving for spring break or summer break, that's not a good sign. You want them to continue to go to school and want to be more at school than getting away from school. Thank you.
Sean, thanks for your call. That's a tough journey from appreciation of school to appreciation of getting out of school, right? No more teachers, no more books.
That's right. But, you know, in defense of the teachers union and others, they have focused almost primarily on benefits and to make the profession more attractive. With our high cost of living here, that certainly is an important element. We know that, for example, for whatever reason, new teachers are 75% are women, which means that young men are not being attracted to the profession, right? I do think HSTA and others are trying to address this issue, and we're trying to get people who are EAs, education assistants, into teaching and various programs like that. But the effort to ensure that you can make a decent living as a new teacher even is an important dynamic to this. Is it attractive enough for young people to say, yes, I want to be a teacher?
I think this is a component of the web, mm-hmm. right? The complexity of everything here that Superintendent was mentioning, where you touch one part of the spider web and the whole other part of the web at the other side is moving, you know, at the same time. So, you know, if you want to move towards different kinds of ideas for teachers and the union is supporting, there's all those other components that come into play all the way down to, you know, what they're doing in the classroom. And I think that a big part of it, going back to mm-hmm. something we talked about at the beginning, is that public charter, private, but also union
yes.
coming into that mix as well.
And I might say that in the last few years, HSTA, the teachers union, has been one of the strongest proponents of requiring the arts and arts education and music into schools, which is not required right now. One of the strongest proponents of early education, one of the strongest proponents of hands-on education. They have tried to find funding mechanisms for these, right? But they've been very, very upfront of wanting to expand the horizons of students and their opportunities. So it might be unfair to point at collective bargaining as a negative force.
We have another caller on the line, Rod from Waikiki. What's on your mind?
Hi, yes. My son's at the Wailea Public Charter School. He's fourth grade. He's been there since kindergarten. And I just want to say a couple things about the importance of patience with change, that quality change takes time. It takes patience. A lot of adults are uncomfortable with rapid rates of change. But I think if teachers, like charter schools can be places where kids love to go, or a regular school. I don't think it's an either or. I think we need to move away from the silo way of thinking where we've got so much that we're busy with that we don't have time as a regular public school or a charter school to share with each other, to do half-day visits, for example. My son loves going to school, and he enjoys what his teachers do. And I think if each teacher each year focuses on improving one facet of their curriculum a bit, I think it can create that continual growth and involvement and investment in making education better for kids. And that's also what I try to do. As I also work part-time at the College of Education at Manoa, and I'm stressed to my students, it's like, you're here to learn how to think. You're here to learn how to innovate. It's not that you're going to ignore the standards, but you need to know what you're trying to do and then couple it to the standards, and not be afraid to innovate and be effective with children by listening to what their interests are and combining your energies, your insights, with the creativity and the desire to learn from the kids.
Superintendent Kishimoto, I know you've only got a few more minutes to be with us, but I wanted to make sure that you got an opportunity to weigh in, particularly on the pace of innovation. That's very much part of your responsibility, isn't it?
It is, and it's really the kind of mindset I'm trying to bring to my leadership here. There is a readiness in Hawaii to really start to look at innovative school designs across our state, and there's a desire to really think about how the system is organized to really support that kind of innovation. I just as a small kind of project, rolled out a grant, an internal grant for our teachers to apply for innovation funds, $1 million set aside for our public schools, which include our charter schools, to have teachers tell us where they would like to receive some funding support so that they do find that the system itself, the leadership, are supporting innovative structures. I think the caller is right on point in saying, you know, what is that opportunity for teachers and students to work together in that kind of collaborative environment to really design around kids and to have the time to do that kind of approach in public education.
I think that you know, the superintendent keeps making some great points here. I think that the entire component of co-creating with students, co-creating with parents, goes back to that idea of developing a community that can move forward. And I think when it comes to school change, you know, in my experience, school change is slow. It's difficult. And that may be true of other areas as well. But, you know, education's just a little bit of a different ilk, right? Teachers are interesting people. They can be a little bit provincial. It makes it a little bit more difficult. In addition to that, when you're talking about change, you're talking about change with students and growth. And they're human beings. And they learn in different ways. And they develop in hormonal change at different times in the physiology.
I wanted to mention that we have not talked at all about higher ed in this way. What does it take to get into a competitive school? You have to do the SAT. So even if you de-emphasize the high-stake tests at K-12, there still is that SAT hanging over there. And I really think, for example, UH Manoa and others could affect how people think in the K-12 world by having alternative experiential portfolios allow students to get in and to encourage that. I went to school to become a music teacher. I didn't take a test. I auditioned on piano and violin and clarinet and baritone and whatnot. That's how I got in. If I were in the visual arts, I would bring in a portfolio of my stuff. If I wanted to be on the football team, I didn't take a bubble test. I tried out, right, you know. And I think that higher ed has been a little bit tone deaf to how they interact with and ask for portfolios and various kind of experiential credentials.
I think some of that is changing.
I hope some
of that is definitely changing, you know, and it's not just the province of the art schools now. It's becoming much more widespread. And then you have things like the Mastery Transcript Consortium, right, which we could go into. It's another conversation. But there's that effort on the part of K-12s mm-hmm. to look at the skills, habits, and dispositions that are absolutely crucial, still allowing schools to develop their own kinds of skills, habits, and dispositions, but providing an opportunity for K-12 to provide universities with more information about students. But I actually disagree on one point, which is I think that though those art portfolios and those things have been around for a long time, I think that it's actually the K-12s that are finally starting to influence the universities in terms of how they take an approach, because for too long it's been about you need to take these SATs, you need to have these scores because we have so many applicants that we have to make these sweeping lines in our admissions. But now that these things are being joined by K-12, they're starting to turn towards K-12 to look at those innovations.
So I'm in complete agreement that the nexus of change really is through the K-12 system, saying we're going to move to much more standards-based approach to grading and portfolio design and alternative assessments. If the HIDOE, the Department of Ed, transitioned away from testing and said we're going to use a portfolio approach, UH Manoa and other colleges would have to respond. Otherwise, they would have to turn away every single one of our students. And so I think the power of K-12 to change how we're looking at these entrance points is something that we shouldn't underestimate.
Superintendent, thanks very much for joining us on the show. I know you have to go. You've got a deadline, but it's really, really appreciate having your perspective on this. I hope we get a chance to do this again.
I'd love to. Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. We haven't heard from the new superintendent, at least on this program, until now. So that's a welcome perspective. You were nodding your head, Evan, as she was saying that last thing about K through 12's impact.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, and I think that actually, the K-12 impact is so unique because, again, we're going back to natural learning, right? We're finding out more and more that the way humans have been living for millennia, these are the things that we need to try and be capturing in our school and training their brain, right? And really focusing on that. And I think that the point that the superintendent made, you know, is very salient. And actually, you know, Sione would probably be, you know, should turn it over to him to comment about this topic, because as a charter school,
we just lost him on the phone, but we're going to try to get him back. But that doesn't lessen the relevance of that discussion.
Yeah, a hot topic these days is civic education, and the issue is not only do you have it, but when you have it. A ninth grade brain is not the same thing as a 12th grade brain, and if we're depending on a student's understanding of American history and democracy as a ninth grader versus a senior, that's different. But also, the colleges have not taken this as a responsibility. Civic education or something like that is not a required course in most of our colleges, right? They have actually walked away from it. They have said, K-12, that's your job, right? And I think that when you are a young adult, just forming your habits of participating in a democracy, and this is one of the key missions of education, right? A citizen in a democracy. When you're a young adult and you're in college and you get nothing, I taught a master's in social work class a few years ago on social policy. I asked, these are all working social workers, I asked, how many recognized the name Patsy Mink? Not a single hand went up. They were not engaged. They're almost proud not to be soiled by politics and democracy and civic ed. So I think that we have continued these silos. I hope the superintendent is right that K-12 can influence higher ed. But I think we have to point at higher ed and say, hey, you're part of this conversation as well.
Sione, we got you back on the line. Sione Thompson is the executive director of the State Charter School Commission. Welcome back. I wanted to
thank you very much.
Make sure we kept your input as part of this discussion.
Sure. I missed the last bit of it, but I absolutely appreciated you know, Mr. Sean's comments and Mr. Beachy, and I did hear a little bit of superintendent. I want to get caught up as to where you are now. I did want to make comment as to what was being spoken about of getting these high-quality teachers and educationalists in front of our students. And what I said earlier in the show about people and getting the right people there. And, you know, in my experience in the private sector, we were never short of resumes for those who wanted to become instructors, teachers, and join the private school that I was at. And it was because mostly what I found out is that, yes, we have to make sure that they can make a decent living, but it was also because people want to find purpose in what they do. And they want to find purpose in these mission-based schools or these schools that have focused on something that's important to them. And when we start finding a methodology for the right people and the right systems for change agents, as superintendent had alluded to. And I think the pace of change will be much quicker than we are used to. And I think working with Ted Dinterschmidt, he had said, the pace of change is quite slow, right up into the point that it happens. And I think that's a very wise comment.
I also want to make a shout out to the College of Education, which does amazing work in curriculum development. And their faculty is very much in tune with what's going on locally, nationally, internationally. We have a new dean who's on top of a lot of issues. There's a lot of excitement in the College of Education and in Manoa and all the courses that those students take. The real key is once they exit that, Are they going to be happy, excited, enthralled in their new job, or are they going to be discouraged? Half of them leave in 5 years. You know, we have a serious issue of the leaky pipeline, if you want, right? There is a great, fantastic preparation for teachers. But the question is, have we sort of constrained their love of teaching in contexts that they don't want to continue? I think the superintendent and others are, and the dialogue that's going to happen tonight, are part of that, right? But we can't let up on the gas pedal for it. We have to make it a wonderful experience to go into a classroom.
I think one thing that you hit on that I needed to make comment on is we also need to rethink this training of our educators as well as this model for if we really want to look forward and be forward thinking and progressive, we need to relook at this model of how we introduce, coach and mentor, and keep resources and support for our teachers in front of the classroom in the hands of those who are in the forefront of these technologies and resources and innovations.
And Evan, I know we were talking earlier before the conversation started. You had attended a conference and talked about the environments that are also very crucial for our early learners.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, dovetailing with all of this is, you know, this conference I went to on learning in the brain had MDs, PhDs in education, and there was a lot of discussion about what they call the 25% rule, where your environment, your physical surroundings impact your brain and the processing centers for learning, and a positive environment with a good, you know, a good social emotional control center relationship results in 25% greater processing speed in the brain. And it's just such a huge thing. And that's something that is also tied in with the facilities and resources and all of those kinds of things. But it's a big problem. We have many, many facets to look at.
Lots of information still being gathered.
Yeah, we'd like to thank our guests, DOE School Superintendent Christina Kishimoto, Sione Thompson, Executive Director of the Charter School Commission, Jim Sean, Director of the Hawaii Educational Policy, and Evan Beachy, Senior Education Consultant and Director of Kealoʻula Innovations Institute.
Thanks to all of our listeners for joining us in that discussion on today's show. You can always reach us through our talkback line at 808-792-8217.
You can send us an email at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. If you want to listen back to the show, check out the Conversation podcast at hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.